Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Saha Viryam Karabhavahai Tejasvi Navadhi Tamastu Mavidvishavahai Om Shanti 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 Yadushmadurasmati Sampratishtha Tasmin vinashte smadimula bhodat. Tasmin vinashte smadimula bhodat. Tadyushmadasman matir mativarjitaika. Yadyushmadasman mativarjitaika. Stitir jwalanti sahajat manasyat. Stitir jwalanti sahajat manasyat. Tad Yushmadoho Asmadi Sampratishtha Tasmin Vinashte Asmadi Mula Bodhat Yad Yushmat Asman Matir Matihi Mati, sorry, not Matir Mati Varjita Eka Stitihi Jwalanti Sahaja. There's three terms. Tad, Yushmat, and Asmat. Tad means that. Yushmat means you. Asmat means I. So when we use these three terms, the word Tad, meaning that, stands for everything that we say is paroksha. Means it's out of our immediate sphere. Like if I were to say, just in English, if I say, do you see, there's that and there's this. This is closer. Right? So that is farther away, that and this. When we say tut, we're really talking here, but when we say tut means that, yushmat means you, and asmat means I. The yushmat, the you, and the I are considered pratyaksha. They're right here in my immediate sphere. So here I am, here you are, right? So I see you like that. It's also idem. It also has the sense of this. So that which is immediately here. So we call that pratyaksha. What's immediately in my experience. So there's you and then there's that. That which is away from my experience. Even in the Mahabhakya, when you say tat tvamasi, that thou art, you are that. What we're meaning is you are Ishwara. You are your own sense of self and your own body, etc., are immediately pratyaksha. They're immediately within your experience. But if I say that you are that Ishwara, you are the Lord. Say if I say that, you are the Lord. The Lord is something paroksha. You have no idea. How can I, this one who is immediate in my immediate sense of experience, the immediacy of my being, how can I, this limited individual, be that? Something that is, for all practical purposes, in my mind, away from me. So even if I say the Mahavakya, which really is the core of what the Vedanta is unfolding, what the Upanishad is unfolding, is that you are that. You are Ishwara. You are the Lord. That's very hard. It's like telling the wave in the wave ocean where you are the ocean. The wave is immediately going to say, I'm not the ocean. They have no concept. So that tat means that which is removed in terms of distance or removed in terms of knowledge. It's not immediately available to me. I could, even if I were to say another Mahavakya, like you are Brahman, aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. The I, the aham, is my immediate experience. And what if I say I, the self that I am limitless. The self that I am is limitless. I am Brahman. I don't have any experience of myself being limitless. But if I say to you, you are limitless, you know, the self that you are, the conscious being that you are, is limitless. If that in fact is true, the limitlessness of who you are is not away from you, if that's true. If you in fact are limitless, that fact if that fact is true, it's not away from you, it's your reality. But it is away from you in terms of knowledge. So in that way, even though it is what we say, it's absolutely not paroksha, it's not away from you in reality, but it is away for, I mean, it's a paroksha. A means negates the paroksha. It's not away from you in reality. But for you, it's paroksha. You have no idea what that means. And so we can break our whole set of experiences down into, in fact, what I experience as myself, what I experience in my immediate vicinity, and what I experience as away from me. And so here, what he's saying is in this first line, he said this concept of tut, of that, those things that are away from me, and the concept of yushmet, you, the things that are protection, the things that are in my vicinity, he said these two things, asmiti sampratishta, all of those are rooted or have their sthana, have their basis in me, in this I. Right? Because now, look in this room, if I say, you know, oh, I see you. I'm talking, if I say, I see you, or I'm experiencing you, or I'm talking to you, what is the you related to? It's related to me. If I say you, then that you is related to me. What if I say, I don't know that? You know, or that is way over there. Then what is that related to? Well, it's related to me. So duality, in fact, is related to me, the subject. I'm the one that is experiencing this world as dual in terms of all of the things that are immediately within my vicinity and the things that are away. But whether they're immediately here for me to experience or they're away for me to have indirect knowledge of, that duality of you and that is only in reference to me, right? For instance, another way of looking at the same thing, what he's saying here, is if I look at the wall, the painting, in reference to my body, in reference to me, this body, this person sitting here, this painting is 10 feet from my body, right? So now I can say, and we'll all agree, if somebody who has knowledge or doesn't have knowledge, self-knowledge, would say, yes, this painting is 10 or 12, whatever it is, feet from this body, from my body. But now, what if I say, this painting is 10 feet from me? If I say that it's 10 feet from me, then I am the body. Right? That means that the subject has become the I. The I has become this limited body, mind, sense organs. And then the you and the that and the distance between one thing or another, the relationship between one thing or another, all make sense. And so that's why he says this concept, these concepts that we experience, my relationship to that, my relationship to you, you know, my relationship to this body, all of those are from the standpoint only of me, the I, what I mean by the word I. And so that's how he starts out. He says, Ted Yushmadoho, that, for that, for the word that, and for the word you, all of them are asmadi, in the I. They have their basis, their sampratishta, they're all rooted in I. Then he says, tasmin vinashte asmadi. When that I, asmadi means when that I, tasmin, tas means that, when that I is destroyed, when that concept, that I concept that you have, which is rooted in the body, mind, sense organs, is destroyed. And how is it destroyed? Mula bodhat. It's destroyed from knowledge of its source. In other words, when you say the word I right now, say you have no knowledge, you have no self-knowledge, you say the word I right now, that I is going to land on something. Okay. So the I usually for a person will land on kind of the body-mind complex. You know, I am this person, this physical body that is such and such an age, you know, that has these thoughts, these relations, this type of a mind, etc. So your sense of I is going to be, if you try to fill in what you mean by I, it's going to be a description of your body, your mind, your sense organs, your relations, etc. So, but that means it's going to be centered on the body, basically. The mind exists within the body, and say the sense organs are there located in the body, the mind is located in the body, all of your relationships are in reference to the body. See what I mean? So that's what that, when you say I, that's where the I lands. What about when knowledge takes place and you now get to what is the true root, where the what is really the source of the I? The mula means the root. What is really its cause? What is really the what we call the upadana karana? What is the actual substance or the actual being that the word I is related to? So once that causal root is understood, is known, then this asmadi, this I, this word I, that is based in things that really have nothing to do with your being, that really are not you, I would say, that are not intrinsically not you. And we'll go into why they're not you in a minute, but if they're intrinsically not you, if that I is destroyed, the I that is landed here is destroyed, then what happens to the relationship between this I, the you, and the that, in reference to who you really are? See what I mean? This I, you, and that as being three separate things are totally dependent upon your concept of you being this body. When that concept is destroyed, because it's rooted in ignorance, in self-ignorance, when that concept is destroyed, then the way you relate to I, you, and that is going to be completely different. You're going to relate to it differently. And so, what does he say? He says, Tad yushmat asmat mati. Tad means that. That, yushmat means you, asmat means I, me. The mati, this thought, so he says. Now, so the whole compound, tad yushmat asmat mati varujita, eka. The one that is totally devoid, varujita, the one, eka, the one, who is totally devoid of these three, I, you, and that, the one who is devoid of that, that stittihi jwalanti sahaja atmanah syat. What he says is, that one, the one that you are, he says, the one who is shining as consciousness, that one comes to recognition, syat. That one comes into recognition. That one becomes recognized. That one which is jwalanti consciousness. That one which is sahaja atmanaha, your natural nature, who you are. That one who you really are. That one becomes recognized. And who is that one? That one is the one who is free of I, you, and that. Okay, so that's the verse. So what he's saying in Vedanta, there's one thing, things that get confusing in Vedanta are these kind of levels of reality. So let's just look at these levels of reality in light of, say, the meadow imagination. You know, instead of dream, I like to use meadow. If you have an imagination of a meadow, the level of reality for you, the one from whom the meadow imagination has come, is quite different than the level of reality of the characters within the meadow. In reality, if the meadow imagination comes from me as a conscious being, From the standpoint of me, the conscious being, there is no duality. Let me make this clear. Think like this. If I have a meta imagination, and we're not talking about body, mind, sense organs, we're now just looking at me, the conscious being who has an imagination. If I have an imagination, right, then the imagination comes from me, the conscious being, is sustained by me, the conscious being, and resolves into me, the conscious being. From the standpoint of the conscious being, what is there before the imagination of the meadow? Like, for instance, I'm not saying I'm not imagining the meadow, I just am. If I just am, just from my own standpoint, I am actually free of the meadow. Why am I free of the meadow? Because the meadow comes into manifestation and goes out of manifestation and nothing happens to me. If I ask you to imagine a meadow, you imagine it, you withdraw the imagination, nothing's happened to you. Something's happened to the meadow, right? Meadow's come into manifestation, it's gone out of manifestation. But for me, I have nothing to do with the presence or the absence of the meadow manifestation. Nothing happens to me. I'm there before, during, and after. I'm just the same. So in fact, I am what we call Eka. My being is Eka. It is simply one. It is a simply one consciousness in reference to this meadow. Not doing anything. It's not becoming the meadow. It's not changing it to become the meadow. It's not going through any modification at all. It just simply is one conscious being. Now, when the meadow comes, when the meadow imagination comes, that's what we call Maya. When the meadow imagination comes, has anything happened to me? No, nothing's happened to me. When the meadow imagination goes away, has anything happened to me? No, nothing's happened to me. And so, therefore, for me, there really isn't any, from the standpoint of me, there really isn't any meadow. Yeah. From this, the only way there's going to even be a meadow is from the standpoint of the meadow. Let me use another example here. We'll use the other type of the clay pot example. If I have a clay pot, from the standpoint of the pot, there's a clay pot. It's from the standpoint of the pot, okay? There's a clay pot. And the pot can say, I am clay, right? It can say, I am a clay pot. But from the standpoint of the clay, there's no pot. There's only clay. You see, it's a big difference. This is like a shift you have to make. Because in fact, there's only clay. In fact. And so from the standpoint of the clay, it's just saying, I'm clay. Clay, 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 clay. That's all. There's nothing here but clay. From the standpoint of the pot will say, I'm a pot and I am clay. This is exactly what we mean by satyam mitya. Satyam is what is actually there. What is actually there is clay. Mitya is that which is there that has no being apart from what is actually there. No reality at all. So now if you change standpoints, if I'm talking from the standpoint of the clay, then I'm only clay. There's nothing there but clay. If I'm talking from the standpoint of the pot, you know, I'm a pot which is nothing but clay. But the pot acknowledges itself, you know. It's the same if you look at, if we go to the next example, if we use wave ocean, you know. From the standpoint of the wave and the ocean, there's a lot to be said. The wave can say, you know, I am one of many waves, right? I am one of many waves, and, you know, I am part and parcel of the ocean, you know. The ocean is the vast ocean, has an order to it, of which, and all of the rules of that order, I am a product of, you know. And so I'm a part of the whole in terms of the ocean. So we can get into a lot of things about the relationship between the waves to each other and the waves to the ocean, and they all have their own reality. But if they start to to look into who they all are, they're going to say, you know, I, the wave, you know, am part and parcel of the ocean, and we are nothing but water. The wave can say that, and it's true. The wave can say, I am nothing but water, and I am part of Ishvara, the ocean. And the ocean also is nothing but water. But and so then the wave becomes an enlightened wave. It says, I am the water, and the ocean is water, and so I am the ocean, because we're all nothing but water. But notice that the wave is having a conversation, right? And the wave is acknowledging its waveness and acknowledging that the wave is only water. And that the ocean itself is only water, and so there's an identity with, there's an identity where it can say, the wave can say, I am water. That's like saying, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. It says, I am water. It can also say, I am the ocean. Because the truth of the ocean is the truth of the wave. They're both water. That's tetramasi. That's when the jnani can say, the one who has self-knowledge can say, you know, I am Ishvara. That's acknowledging myself as a jiva and Ishvara as the myself as a wave, Ishvara as the ocean. I can say, I am Ishvara, because the only thing that is really here is water. And so the water that I am is the water that Ishvara is. The water that the Lord is, the water that the ocean is. So this is what one guru wave teaches to the Sisha wave. So that both, now the guru wave knows we're only really just water, and the Sisha wave says, yes, I'm only really just water. But now, notice what I'm saying here is that this conversation is taking place on the level of mithya. It's on the level of a reality or a series, complex series of experiences that we call this universe, or the universe of the wave ocean universe. It's a very complex set of experiences of jivas and of Ishvara and all different levels of dimension, different levels of reality, all within this maya that we call this huge maya upadhi. But it's maya. Maya means that this experience that we're having is totally dependent on something else for its being, and without that it has zero, zip, no existence whatsoever. Just like the clay has no existence whatsoever from the pot has no existence whatsoever from the clay, and the whole wave ocean, you know, complex reality and relationship of waves with each other and with the ocean as a whole, it has no being apart from water. So now, if you go to the standpoint of the water, what will the water say? There's only water. Period. There is nothing but water. That's the water talking. If the water could talk, it would say, water. I see nothing but water. Right? So you need the one who's doing all the talking is the maya. That's mitya. It's important to understand this. Satya mitya. It's this Satyam Mitya. The Mitya says, you know, it can say, I am the water and I'm experiencing myself as a wave, but really there's nothing here but water. Because it has to, it's accounting for its own reality. See that? The waves and the ocean have a reality. And they have, the waves and the ocean have a reality that we call an objective reality. In other words, the wave is the wave. The waves are the waves. They are whatever size they are. You know, that's Ishvara. The wave ocean, as they are, is Ishvara. There's an objective reality to maya. It's what we call vyavaharika. It's an empirical reality. It's just not an absolute reality. Within this vyavahara, this empirical reality of all of the waves in reference to the ocean, or all of us in relation to each other and to the universe and all of the laws of the universe, both internal and outward, psychological, biological, all of the different orders that are running through the universe of duality. You know, this order has an objective empirical reality where what we call a shared existence. you know, that we can explore and that we can talk about, and that there's science here. There's, you know, there's things that we can more or less depend upon. They're stable. But that objective level of reality is fine, and we function in this level of reality. But then what is its truth ultimately? You know, the truth of this objective level of reality, you know, is not going to be found by going in more and more into the names and forms. You know, the more you go into the names and forms of this objective level of reality, all you're doing is dividing it up into smaller and smaller forms. But you're missing the water, right? Like, say you have, you know, water in a little form, or water in a big form, or water in a form of foam, or water in a form of a big wave. And you can say, you know, oh, you know, we can have big waves, and we can have small waves, and we can have little tiny waves, and we can have waves that relate to each other, but we're still all within the world of waves. So like that, within this creation, we can be working back and forth through our sense perception, gaining all kinds of knowledge about the relationship of one form to another. And that all is true within that level of reality. There is a shared existence and empirical existence. And then on top of that shared empirical existence, where we can all agree that this is a rug and this is a table, there's also what we call, you know, it's called pratibhasika. It's subjective reality that gets superimposed upon this shared reality. Subjective reality is what we're working with in psychology all of the time. If somebody raises their eyebrow in a certain way, and, you know, you think it means this and that and the other thing, that's all subjective reality. Or you mistake a rope for a snake. That's what we humans do. We're projecting, you know, we're projecting upon this objective reality. And so that's its own subjective Maya. Every one of us, every individual, everybody that has a mind and sense organs, projects upon the shared reality that you experience. And so now we have a Maya upon a Maya. Right? We have Maya upon Maya. That's why in the Vedanta we'll say there's Ishvara Srishti, which is the actual objective reality of the waves and the ocean. The actual objective reality of what is actually here that we are experiencing in terms of the complex order of names and forms. We project our own unconscious, really, on top of that, and give it a variety of different meanings that may or may not have anything to do with the object that we're experiencing. That's a projected reality. You with me on this? Because I'm getting going somewhere and I need you to follow it. When we're talking about, and this is where things get confused, I think, in Vedanta. When we talk about subjective reality, like, for instance, mistaking a snake for a rope. Rope for a snake. Mistaking a rope for a snake. That has a very ephemeral quality. Right? Because that projection is not, that in no way can outlast the rope. Right? So it's very ephemeral. It's Maya. It's magic. We can use words like ephemeral, or it's an illusion. So if I say, that's amazing, I just mistook that rope for a snake. It was an illusion. Right? And so we know what that illusion means. It's very airy fairy, it's very ephemeral. And so, and we can say it's an illusion, it's a delusion, it's a projection. All of these words we use. And we use those words for Maya. Okay? When we use those words for Maya, then we look at this shared reality that we call Vyavahara. We say, this is Maya. This is an illusion. You know, this is illusion, it's delusion, it's ephemeral, it's an appearance, it's woo-woo. See what I mean? Because we are looking at our own subjective Maya that gets projected upon the object of Maya, and then we label the object of Maya with words that match our experience of illusion. So anyway, we have subjective reality, Maya. Subjective reality, which is superimposed upon objective reality, which is this Ishwar Srishti. So in Vedanta we'll say, there's the Ishwar Srishti, there's the objective creation of Ishwar, Lord's creation, how the creation actually projects what is actually there. And then upon that, there's the Jiva Srishti, what the individual projects upon that. And then there's the instead of Vyavahara and the Pratibhasika, there's then the what we call absolute reality. So we have absolute reality, objective reality, and subjective reality. The absolute reality is called Paramarthika Satyam. That is what is the truth of both the objective reality and the subjective reality. So now if I keep these three things and we go back to our wave ocean. Paramarthika Satyam, absolute reality, is the water. That is, in fact, what is the truth of the objective reality. The objective reality is the wave ocean. That's the shared reality. But the underlying truth of that is only water. And so from the standpoint of the water, the absolute reality, the water will say, I'm water. I'm nothing but water. No matter what is going on in the objective reality, there's nothing there but water. You see that? And so that's all that's the only experience there is. It's the only non-dual experience there is. For the water is water. That's it. There's no wave water. There's no Ishwara water. Ocean water, there is only water. There's no name and form because there's nothing outside of water. So name and form even aren't there. You see that? From the standpoint of the objective reality, we can say the shared reality, there is name and form. And the name and form are whatever they are. Whatever the name and form actually is, that's the Vyavahara, that's Ishwara's creation. That phenomena is what we call Maya. That there can be such a thing, that there can be a complex phenomena that has no being whatsoever apart from its substance, water. So there's a difference. If the phenomena of the creation or the phenomena of the wave ocean looks at, can comment, because there's a mind, they have minds, jivas have minds, you know, can comment on that reality, and can also mistake the reality. And so, if the wave mistakes the reality because it has a mind, jiva mistakes the reality because it has a mind, then it's in trouble. Because if it mistakes the reality, it immediately becomes limited. Just like a wave, if a wave misses that it is water, see, the water has no limitation. There's nothing but water. From the standpoint of this illustration. But if the wave misses its waterness, then it becomes limited and subject to birth and death and different from other waves, you know, and completely subject to duality. This wave, which has no being apart from the water, has to know that, or it's limited and subject to birth and death in its mind. In fact, it's not subject to anything. In reality, it's like when you wake up from a dream, you could have been totally identified with a character in the dream. And all kinds of things could have happened in the dream, and in fact, nothing happened. And even when the whole dream, you know, goes away when you wake up, nothing has happened to you at all. Even though you had totally identified with the character in the dream, and that's who you were. In fact, you never were that. You never were that. But because you thought you were that, you had a whole series of events, and including, you know, your demise, which never took place. You know, your demise and the expectations of your demise, all of that, all of the fear and everything that was generated around that, never happens, never could happen, never will happen at any time, because who you really are, you know, is the self, or is the conscious being, or for the wave is the water. Nothing happens to the water. Nothing happens to the self, ever. Okay, but now we have Ishwara's the reality of the objective creation, and then you as a jiva within that creation, all of your projections upon it. You know? And the projections upon it from the standpoint of a jiva are very frightening. They're very frightening because there is no consciousness in my mind of who I am. If my mind is filled totally with the experiences of Vyavahara, of empirical reality, and my projections upon it, all of them based in ignorance of who the I is, who the self is. Now go back to the meadow imagination. If you are Ishwara, and you are Ishwara, you are the Lord of the meadow imagination, you are the creator. You're the one who is you have sarvagnyatvam. You're omniscient in terms of the meadow that you imagine. You're God. You're the Lord of the meadow imagination. You have Maya under you're the Mayavi. You have Maya under your control, like Ishwara is the Mayavi. You have Maya under your control. You imagine the meadow completely. A whole world, a whole activity is going on. You withdraw the meadow. The meadow is withdrawn into yourself. And you can imagine it again and withdraw it again, imagine it again. You're the Mayavi. There's no fear. There's no Ajnanam. You have your what we call Sarvashaktiman. You have all power. Ishwara is Sarvashaktiman. He has all power. He is Sarvajnaha. He is omniscient. Right? Just like if you have an imagination, it's your Shakti, the Maya Shakti, your personal Maya Shakti that projects that world. And once it's projected, it's known. So you're the Ishwara, you're omniscient to the meadow. And so for you, the meadow is nothing but you. It has no being, no substance apart from you. And even from the standpoint of consciousness, there isn't even a meadow. There isn't a meadow because the meadow has to be there in order to be known. So say when the meadow's not projected, it's not there, so there's nothing to be known. The knownness even of the meadow requires that it be there, that it be projected. For consciousness, it's only consciousness is only consciousness. Me, the self, is only me. So from my standpoint, nothing is going on. But since something is going on from its standpoint, something is going on. But so if I'm the Ishwara of the meadow, then that's the meadow experience from the Ishwara standpoint. But within the meadow, there are limited beings that are part and parcel of the meadow. They're not sarvagnyaha. Those beings within the meadow, they're alpagnyaha. They have limited knowledge. They're alpashakti. They have limited capacity. They have limited sense organs, limited experience, all taking place within the meadow. And so those beings are in a pickle, really. Because here they are, they are existing within the meadow, looking around within the meadow. All of their experiences only has to do within the time space of the meadow. And so the dimension of I, you, that, this, the space-time dimension that they are totally caught in, they're totally caught in the time-space dimension and at the duality of my experience between I and you and that, you know. But all of that dimension, that duality, is all only from within the standpoint of the Maya Meadow. From my standpoint, the truth of the Maya Meadow, this duality doesn't exist. In fact, I am. And this I am, the conscious being that I am, is the self of the I person in the meadow, the you person in the meadow, and the that in the meadow. There's only one me there. And so for a jnani, even in this experience right now of this room, there is only one me here that illumines the wall, for instance. Like, say, if I were to say, and we have to shift our standpoint here, in this room, because of my sense organs, so this is where I'm picking up from last week, because of my sense organs, I'm experiencing this room. Right? And included in the experience of this room is this body, mind, sense organs. And you, and all of the things in this room. But this body is also. And so in my awareness, this I is included, and you are included, and the things I don't know outside of the room are included. In the sense that I know that there's something beyond. You see what I mean? So, actually, the I, this, here's the I, here's the you, and here's the these things that make up this room. All of these things now are included in my consciousness. The I, the you, and the that. And so where is the consciousness? The I is included in my knowledge, the you is included, and the that is included. Everything in this room is included in my consciousness. How far is my consciousness from any given thing? How far am I from the painting? This body is 10 feet from the painting. How far is the paint that's 10 feet from my body? How far is the painting from my consciousness? How far is the lamp from my consciousness? How far are you from my consciousness? How far is this body from my consciousness? How far are my sense organs from my consciousness? There's no distance. Right? So now if you think about it, in this room, I'm aware of this room now because I have a thought modification of it. And this thought modification, a mental thought, born through my sense perception, is illumined by consciousness. The whole thought. Do we see? And this body, mind, sense organs is included in the thought. So are you, and so are you, and so is everything. So actually this whole thought exists in me. I am the self of the thought. And there's nothing away from me. There's nothing away from my being because everything is. There's nothing away from consciousness because everything is known. So I, in fact, am the self of the thought. Harder to see than when you say, when I ask you to have a thought of a meadow. Imagine a meadow. Put a lot of people in it. Put trees in it. Put the sun and sky in it. Have a thought of a meadow. And then I say, that entire thought is in your consciousness. You're the truth of the meadow. Right. Easy. Yeah. This is a thought. A thought of the room. You have a thought of the room based on coming through sense perception. The whole thought is in your consciousness. You are the self of the thought. What's included in the thought? Everything that's included in the thought is enjoying one being, which is known. Everything in the thought is known. Everything in the thought is. The knownness of the isness is me. Right? There's no difference in your experience between the experience of a thought of a meadow imagination, and a perception. There's no difference in the dynamics of conscious being that illumines the vritti, the thought modification. The thought modification can be generated by anything. It can be an emotion, it can be an imagination, it can be a perception, it can be a dream. It doesn't make any difference what it is. Whatever it is, you never have any experience that isn't in total pervaded by your being. Your being is what we call the sampratishta. Everything is rooted. Everything has its essence in the one being that you are. But we, of course, don't see it like that. You know? We don't see it like that because I am the I, the ahankar, is totally identified with this body, mind, sense organs, and so I'm only experiencing this world or defining this world from the standpoint of this I. I've entered the dream. Right? I'm only relating to the reality that I experience from within Maya. Like only from the wave experiencing other waves, or from the dream character within the dream. I am experiencing this creation from within it, from the standpoint of this body, mind, sense organs. And since I have a mind, and that mind can talk and can think and enjoys consciousness, which is the self of everything, that mind says, I am this. It's a very natural mistake for it to say that. But so even though the reality of my experience right now is that everything I experience has no distance at all from the Sat-Chit, the conscious being that I am. There's no, even though we have the time-space duality here, there is nothing in the time-space duality that we're experiencing that has any distance from me. But I'm only defining my experience from the standpoint of this body, mind, sense organs. And that's what I've always done from beginningless time, from beginningless births. So the Dehatma Buddhi, this point of identification, is totally entrenched. It's totally entrenched. That's why, you know, when a student comes to the teacher to be taught, say an Upanishad, or to be taught this knowledge, the teacher just can't say, you're free, limitless, be happy, go in peace. You can't say that. You can say it, but nothing happens. So for something, the mind actually has to go through some gyrations to actually recognize that everything about you that you've identified with as yourself, your body, your mind, your sense organs, your moods, your emotions, everything, you know, is actually known. There's actually a subject-object differentiation with that. And you are always the subject, never the object. You can never be the object. You can be the pot recognizing yourself as the clay, you know. You can, when that differentiation from Maya takes place, what happens is that you recognize that everything that is objectified, right, has no being apart from awareness. But the awareness that you are is not dependent upon that, upon it. It's dependent upon you. That's the mitya. But you're not dependent on it. That's why when you start really looking at your experience, including subject and object, you recognize that, wow, there's part of my experience that never changes at all. And that part is what is the satyam. That's the reality, and that part never changes at all, is never away, can never be separated from or distanced from any experience that you have. You can't have an experience that is away from that. That's what I'm saying. But all of the experiences that you have come and go and come and go, like the waves in the ocean. They come and go and they come and go and they come and go. But they come and go in you, who are never changing at all. Never at all. And you can even do meditative meditations where you try to make yourself change. Try to touch yourself, you know, to... How to make yourself change. How to do anything at all to affect yourself. The conscious being that you are. I mean, you can pinch yourself, you can do all kinds of things with your body, you can do all kinds of things with the vrittis, the thought modifications. But try to do something with you, the one because of whom all these things are known, because of whom all these... Try to do something with your amness, just your being, or with your consciousness. All of the things, like all of the moods that you're having, you know, all of the emotions that you have, all of the complexes that you have, all of the different things that go on in the world can be very complex, very disturbing, very happy, where they can be whatever they are. And they're continually changing, but you are not. And that part is not known, because that part, it's not really a part, it is actually the whole. It's not like the clay is part of the pot, you know. But that part, when you're differentiating from the Maya, is not recognized, because it's so taken for granted, because it's the self of every differentiated experience that you have. So you're only differentiating experiences. You're not recognizing the thing that is never differentiated, that is always there as the underlying reality of everything. And that is the most intimate me, you know? It's the me that remains when the dream, when you wake up from the dream. Have you ever had that experience where you wake up from the dream and you realize nothing's really happened and you're still there? Yeah, sometimes it's a great relief, especially when it was a bad dream. You know, but the dream goes away and it's just an uncanny moment. It's an uncanny moment where the dream goes away. And it could have been just a very intensely numinous, real, very intensely numinous, real dream. It goes away, and what you realize is that nothing has happened. This incredible dream has gone away, and absolutely nothing has happened. That the entirety of its being is your non-dual self, and there was nothing else there. And that dream, with all of its dimension and all of its complexity, you know, actually, it's nothing. It has no being. Nothing was lost. It's not that it has no being. The being that it was is not lost. What it actually was is not lost. And can't be lost. You know? And so you can imagine what it means to gain knowledge. Just think of the dream character in the meadow. When the dream character in the meadow actually recognizes that there's really nothing here but me. I am the very content, I'm the very self of the whole thing. And all of these experiences that we have, including the emotional dimension, which is the most disturbing for everyone. The emotional dimension, we like the positive spectrum, but the negative is harrowing. But these are all like waves and froth. They're just waves and froth. And they are complex and they're colorful in every dimension, in sound and in taste and in, you know, sight and in the emotional fabric. But it's all just foam. But the foam is water. And that water never is not there, and nothing's happening to it. That's why, you know, the world goes through so much, but this body is part and parcel of it. The whole thing is Ishvara, all of it. Your mind, your sense organs, your body, your relations, the unconscious. There is nothing that is not Ishvara. And Ishvara is Mithya. This body is Mithya, Ishvara is Mithya. Mithya means, Mithya is not, Ishvara is an illusion. It's not what it is. It's that Ishvara is Brahman. It's not that Ishvara is an illusion. Ishvara is Vyavahara. It's a very complex shared reality, but the truth of it is Brahman. Like the truth of the pot is clay. You know? The only thing here is Brahman, and that's who you are. Brahman is personal. Personal meaning there's only one of us. And that one is personal. It's me. When you say me, for a person to gain knowledge, what is the recognition is that, the I that I've always, that is me, that me, that has always been me, is Brahman. It's not that, I'm Brahman. No, it's that this me, that's so very personal me, that makes me, is Brahman. There is no other personal me. The personal me that you already now identify with. A good exercise to do is you think, okay, I am this body. Because we don't have to work at that. We all know, okay, I'm this body. It's also true. It's like saying the pot saying I'm the clay. And say, I am the body. So then you say, what is the essence of me, the body, that makes me? What is it? Not the changing thoughts or the aches and pains, but just my being. And then you recognize that that being that has always been you, that you've always labeled as you, that being is Brahman. You've labeled it as you in this way, I am, and then you make the mistake, the body. But the first part, if you were just cut it off right there, you say, I am, and you say, I am the body-mind. But the I am, that first part that you're superimposing onto the body-mind, that is the truth. That is Brahman. That is the reality. Now you have to recognize that, oh, this reality of who I am is limitless. Is non-dual, is the very self of all of this, Maya. When you realize I'm the self of all of this, then I say, you know, I am Ishvara. And that's the truth. In Vedanta, it's not just I am Brahman. It's I am Ishvara. Because to say I am Ishvara, you then recognize that all of this infinite display that we call the creation is me. It's like you being able to say, the wave being able to say, not just I am water, but I am ocean. If you can say I am ocean, then all of this is nothing but you. So it's, you're in the most familiar territory. This is not somebody else here. Like if you say, why did Bhagavan do this to me? That's a good question. Why did you do this to you? Why did you do this? And Bhagavan will say, I'm beginningless. I didn't do anything. This is how it is. This is what it is. And from the standpoint of me, the conscious being, there is no time or space. Nothing's ever happened. All is fine. All is well. Okay, so he moves on. We'll move on next week. Let's take just a moment. Purnamidah, Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamidachate, Purnasya, Purnamadaya, Purnameva, Vashishate, Om Shanti, 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 Harihi Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha, Harihi Om.
Can you know Brahman and still think that I am the body? Can you still, is that doable? I mean, it not seems like both happens. You know.
Not in the same way as before. Like say you've recognized yourself as you are, but you still have this body. So you're going to have a sense of being this body as opposed to being the table. It's not all of a sudden that you realize I am Brahman and you don't have a body sense, or your body becomes like the table. It that won't be so because you have a sukshma sharira, you know. But to believe that you are this body in the way that you believed it before, where it wasn't even a belief, it wasn't even about a belief, mm-hmm. you know. It's just, if I'm something else, show me. You know, you can say, like, maybe I'm a soul. What is that? You know? But there's just no knowledge. You just are operating from the standpoint of being the body-mind. Naturally operating from that standpoint. And that's just not true anymore. Even though you're operating as the body-mind, as long as you have one, this conviction that that is you is not there anymore because you've recognized who you are. And so the ahankara, the I thought, doesn't land on your body as being you. It lands on yourself as being you. You see what I mean? But then this body still has the sense of I. It's not like you're not going to say, I'm not this body.
No, the body still says, I am you.
Body says, I am you, Brahman, or I am you.
It says... it's tricky. I mean, you can know that you never change and there's no body there, and at the same time what you illumine says that I am this body, says I am you, but it isn't me.
No, wait a minute. You have to be careful. This is another tricky thing. With this understanding satyam mitya, the like with the clay pot. The pot says, I am clay. Now, for the ajnani clay pot, can say, I am clay. But it takes the clay to be dependent on the pot.
Right.
But the jnani clay pot will say, I am clay, and I, the clay, am free of the pot. So, you have to be able to say both. To say both is not just an intellectual thing. It's a recognition of the fact. You recognize the silent, stable, changeless presence of your being, that no matter what happens, no matter what the thoughts are, no matter what the moods or the emotions are, no matter what's going on in the body, those things are all perceived, they're all experienced, but your presence remains constant. So you can then say, all of these things are me and I am free of them. That's what has to be said. All this stuff can become very notional, like thinking, I know myself only when, you know, or I'm with myself only when these things are not here. In other words, let me sit in nirvikalpa samadhi, and then I'm with myself. If I'm not in nirvikalpa samadhi, you know, then I'm not knowing myself. Or if my mind is having a bad day, if I'm having a bad mood, you know, then I'm not with myself. But that isn't true. It's like the sun illumining clouds and then feeling, oh, I'm covered by the clouds. I mean, the sun isn't going to feel I'm covered by the clouds. It's illumining the clouds. It's nothing's happening to the sun at all. Yeah. So that's become focused on, let your mind focus on what's being said at the time of teaching and in contemplation. Because the words are actually pointing to something there that you need to recognize. It's not like the Vedanta isn't talking theoretically. It's actually talking about, it's descriptive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of logic and all of that, but it's descriptive logic. It's talking about something which is yourself, not a theoretical self, but a self to be seen, you know, to be recognized, like the words are pointing. That's why Vedanta is considered a pramana, a means of knowledge, because the words are pointing to something that is there. And so if you're listening to it as a lecture, you know, you're gathering information type of a lecture, then you're just still caught in samsara, really. You're gaining some philosophical data, you know, but the words aren't doing the job. So that's why, you know, you have to, teacher also has to say, tell how to listen, what these words are doing, how the pramana works, what's happening at the time of teaching, you know, what are guided meditations. And when we do guided meditations, it's kind of a slowed down shravana, slowed down class. You know, just make you sit in one space for a while.
Carol, can you say something about who it is that has the recognition and in what sense it's a recognition?
Who has the recognition is the mind.
Mm-hmm.
But you have, we would say like this, knowledge, gaining knowledge, is actually, we say it in the negative, in that we say ajnana nivritti. Ajnana nivritti means your gain of knowledge is really the elimination of ignorance. Because the thing is that yourself, the conscious being, is already present. It's already self-luminous as consciousness. Right? And so, in one sense, the self, the I that you are, is what we call aparoksha. It's self-established, it's self-shining. It doesn't need to be lit up by anything. You don't need to bring in another consciousness to light up the consciousness that you are. So that is going to be the self-experience of self-luminous, the self-luminous being that you are, is not going to be knowledge of that. Is not going to be gained. And then you gain the experience, let me put it this way, the experience of yourself is not going to be gained because it's already there. Whereas in all other types of knowledge, you have to gain the experience of it, and then you gain the details about the experience that you've gained. Here the experience, self-experience, is always there as a given. And so what has to happen is that the mind, because you are always a given to the mind as being the very self of the mind, remember the satya mitya, you're the very self of the mind has made a mistake in how it relates to the self, itself. It says, it's like the pot saying, I am the clay. You know, instead of recognizing that satya mitya relationship where the very self of the mind is also free of the mind. You know, so that mind can recognize then that it itself is objectified. It itself is changing. Itself is known. Itself comes and goes in its forms, and it's changing forms and moods and emotions and perceptions. But the conscious being, which is its very self, is not changing at all. The mind can recognize that. And in that, it realizes its mistake. It's not the gain of a new self or recognition of the self. It's a viveka, a discrimination that eliminates the superimposition that the mind has made. From the standpoint of the self, the self is not ignorant. There's no duality from the standpoint of the self. So it's not going to become better or become worse. It just simply is, you know. But the mind, you know, has all of the problem. And that's why sometimes playing along with the meadow imagination and people in it, what their situation would be versus you. You know, it's a totally different situation. And what would it take for the character in the meadow to recognize I am the self, or I am in fact the meadow?
So you can say that the mind is liberated from its own error, but you don't actually change.
That's right. It's liberated, we wouldn't say from its own error, because there's no prior condition. It didn't make a mistake, it's a beginningless mistake. That's brought about by the very situation of Maya itself. Just like for you, if you imagine a meadow, you have no mistake, right, from your standpoint of being the Mayavi, but everybody in the projection will be limited by the very nature of the projection itself. So that's why we say the Ajnanam is beginningless. It doesn't have a prior condition. So otherwise you say, oh, you made a mistake. Well, when did you ever have it right, you know, to make the mistake?
Okay. Yeah. So the teaching is all just for the relief of this mind.
Yeah, it's for the relief of the jiva. It gets you out of the situation that through no fault of your own. It's just the very nature of Maya. That's where the Ajnanam is. The Ajnanam is beginningless because if you think, what would the prior condition be? Yeah.
So you see, so just to get this straight about the different projections. So the jiva, the jiva srishti is actually equal to the projected reality.
Subjective reality. Jiva srishti. Srishti means creation.
Uh-huh.
So jiva srishti is the creation of the jiva. That's like seeing the snake on the rope, subjective reality. Ishwara srishti is the rope. It's what is actually there, that is not the projection of the jiva.
Objective
reality. And so, I mean, we are always a combination, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we always have some sort of, at least from a psychologist will say, there's always some amount of projection going on there, because you don't have total knowledge of anything that you perceive. Sense, but we're talking about the extreme cases where the projection is obvious.
And so the word srishti actually means
creation. The word srishti means creation. So if I say the creation of the jiva, or the creation of Ishwara, Ishwara's creation, and then the jiva's creation is the subjective reality upon Ishwara's creation. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
I'll be right back.
Satyam is actually Brahma.
Brahman.
It's actually, so that's a kind of, you can...
Paramartika Satyam, when they say, what is Satyam? What is true? What is absolute? What is that? Paramartika means absolute. What is the absolute truth, the absolute reality?
Mm-hmm.
They define that as that which can't be... Sorry, I'm going to turn on the heater. The window
is
freezing in here.
The windows are open too.
Okay. Might as well solve the problem right at the end. Okay, so Paramartika means absolute. So Paramartika Satyam means, Sat comes from, first Satyam, comes from the root us to be. Us becomes Sat, and then Satya, that state of being itself. So be that which actually is Satyam. So that's what we mean by reality, that which actually is. So the definition of being or reality is that which cannot be negated in past, present, or future. Because if it can be negated, then it goes out of being. It comes into being and goes out of being. Then that's considered mitya. So that which cannot be negated in past, present, or future is called satyam. And the only thing, nothing within duality, fits that definition. Everything within duality is subject to change. So only Brahman is free from change. So see, existence, if you get more into it, existence itself can't have a prior condition. Just think about that. Being can't have a prior condition. What would its prior condition be? Non-existence. Right? Being's prior condition would be non-existence.
Or a dimmer being.
No.
A lesser.
No, because then you have change. That dimmer being, then you're getting into name and form again. Yeah. But is it, say if you do say dimmer being, dimmer, 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 and then where does the dimmer end up? Yeah, in non-existence.
Not there.
Yeah. And so now we have non-existence for being, prior condition. And then what is going to come out of the non-existence? Is being going to come out of something that's not there? Non-existence, literally, it means it's not there. It does not exist. Nothing is there. Zero. What is going to come out of nothing? What's going to change nothing into something? So being can't have a prior condition. That's why it's changeless. If it doesn't have a prior condition, that means it doesn't change. Ever. That's a good meditation. It's one of those kind of meditations that kind of breaks your mind. A little bit, screw up your mind. In a good way.
Well, that's,
but then you start thinking, then notice your own being. And you just try to, you realize it's untouchability. There's nothing you can do to change it or do it. You can't do anything with it. It is. The I, the self of the I. I is a word, right? The Atma, the self, which is limitless because there's no, it has no beginning, it has no end, it's not moving, it simply is, and you can't objectify it and make it Maya. You can't have a subject-object relationship with it, you just simply are. Always. And that's why when, as a jiva, body, mind, sense organs, in a beginningless history of being a jiva, within Maya, when your mind, you get this knowledge, then your mind starts acting up and getting kind of sucked out into the samsara of the world and of your life. For some time, you just have to bring it back. We have all different ways of helping the mind and helping it with its traumas and problems. That's important too. But in the end, you get used to just when it starts getting itself in trouble, getting all involved, you just bring it home. You just keep bringing it home to its own truth. It's like the pot bringing itself home to its clay, to the reality because we can't go into all of this, I suppose, tonight, but anyway, just quickly. The ananda or the wholeness that you seek in the world, is only your being. That's what you seek in the world. And so once that's understood, it's not that your being, the I, the self that you are, is miserable. the self that you are is whole and complete. It's what you're always seeking. And then you have those moments and you say, oh, this is me. This is how I'm supposed to be. And then the mind freaks out and as though it takes that away. You know, because it doesn't take it away ever, really. But it's creating so much pain, you know, that the mind doesn't care about that wholeness that's illumining it, the well-being that's illumining it, because it's caught in a lot of pain, you know. But that all settles down, you know, and as the mind itself discovers that what it's actually seeking is your own nature, you know, then there's no distance between your nature and the mind. It's just that when the mind's looking out here in Maya for it, in samsara for it, and of course it's not finding it, and there's all these obstructions and nothing's working out, it can get very hurt and very upset. But it's getting hurt and upset and angry and all of these things because you're asking to get your wholeness in a place where it doesn't exist, where it's already there. You know, the wholeness is already there. But the mind's getting lost in the waves and the froth and the foam and the, you know.
Well, why is the mind like that? It seems to notice change and ups and downs, but it doesn't seem to notice what's constant. It doesn't.
Because there's nothing, no time when that constant isn't there. And so it only notices the change. The constant is there in every moment of the change. Right? The constant is never not there. And so it's not there. It's not there to ever be noticed.
Oh, you don't notice its absence then.
Because it'll never be absent. It's the given. It's like sometimes they use the example like a fish in water. You know? It never notices the water because the water is the constant. You know, you're the constant. But the experiences are swirling and the mind is capable of getting itself into a lot of different states. You know, emotions. Anyway, we have to work more on the ananda aspects. I mean, if the self wasn't ananda, who would want it?
So is the rock dwesh really coming to a full stop in the moment where there's full understanding?
It doesn't come to a stop. There's still preferences, but they don't matter. It's not that you don't have preferences, like Swamiji always tells the story of the two sadhus. One's from North India and likes chapatis, and one's from South India and is used to idlis. And they go to a restaurant and they order, but the waiter gets everything confused. So the North Indian gets the idlis and the South Indian gets the chapatis.
So the preference still fall into rock dwesh for you, huh?
I would rather have this than that. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, it's not the same. It's like, say if you look at this is the full desire template. I want this so that I can be happy. That's an ajnani. I want this so that I can be happy, and I don't want this so that I can be happy. Both ways, right? For ajnani, it's I want this and I don't want that, but not so that I can be happy. And so the raga dvesha are like burnt seeds. They don't, if I don't get what I want, that's okay. If I get what I want, that's okay. If I don't get what I want, that's okay. Because I'm not at stake. My ananda, my wholeness, my fullness isn't at stake. But that actually gives a lot of freedom because then I'm free to engage in the world, you know. And it gives you, the people around you, a lot more freedom too, because you don't always need them to be a particular way so that you can be happy. You don't need anything to be a particular way so that you can be happy. Which is, it's not that we don't have preferences. It's some, you know, that a preferences part is important. Otherwise, the world all becomes just flat. You're just kind of walking around in this flat world. That's not what it is. You have your prarabdha, you have your preferences, you have the directions you go in as opposed to other directions. You know, the things that you love to do, where you have your energy, all of that, that's all karma. But the self remains the same. Mm-hmm. Your self isn't getting upset. Now, your mind can get upset or this or that. Your self doesn't get upset. Whether you're jnani or jnani, the self does not get upset. It's always the same. It's always whole. It's always complete. It's just the ajnani doesn't differentiate, doesn't even know about that. It's just blended in. Your being is just blended and confused with all of your experiences. But the jnani, for the jnani, that's not true. You are there, period. You're there. And the experiences are there too. But because you are there, the experiences, the intensity of the extreme experiences are mitigated by your own, by the wholeness of your own presence. And so your mind calms down, because remember, the mind wants to be happy. The mind wants to be you. You can put it like that. It wants to be you. And if it thinks you are out there in the form of an object, then it has to, you know, try to make the world give it to you. And that doesn't work. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's very tension-producing. You're trying to make it work and nobody's cooperating. <You know>? And then it can be really important to you also that it work in that particular way. And the more important it is to you, the more stressful it is. And the more annoying it is when people aren't shaping up properly.
So easy said, you know. I mean, the truth is so profound, but the matrix is so deep, you know. It's yeah. And we're all in it, you know. We're all in it in our own ways. And so.
Knowledge assimilates itself through your system slowly but surely. Mm-hmm. Through your system, through the way you orientate toward life, and takes its time. Some of the complexes or the way we orientate toward life are much, much more deeply rooted, mm-hmm. you know, in our experience than other ways. And even though some of them are very, cause a lot of pain, it's kind of like the monkey, their hand in the jar, holding onto nuts, and that little, there's just a little hole in the jar, and so it can't get its hand out until it lets go of the nuts, but it wants the nuts. And so it'll take any amount of punishment and beating so that it can have the nuts before it realizes it has to let it go. And finally, when it's almost dead, it'll let it go and scamper off. It's how horrible it is for some of the more intense complexes and desires that we have. You just take a beating, take the beating, till finally you let go, and then you can't believe you took so long to let go. But you can't let go until you can let go. You know?
Yeah, if you would have not gone through the process, which is a form of refinement process.
Yeah.
You know, you can't even say through the beating in a certain way. You would have not actually come out on the other side. You know?
Yeah.
Also, I mean, you cannot. There's no bypass to this whole thing. You know, there's no spiritual bypass. You know, I'm enlightened and I'm declaring this and use all my positivism. You know, it's like it's really not working, right?
Yeah. Yeah. There's no shortcut. Or should there be? Yeah. Bhagavan doesn't let you fake it. You can't fake it. But then Swamiji says, fake it till you make it.
Well,
that's also
like
true.
Change your program and get out of your fixation.
Yeah.
That's what he means, really,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, well, with the fake it till you make it, it's really, it's just a tongue-in-cheek, because What the best way I think of seeing that is you have certain values mm-hmm. that you can't live up to yet, but they are your values. Mm-hmm. And so you act on those values even though you may be feeling something else. Mm-hmm. So you're really not faking it. On the deepest level, you're not really faking it at all. You're living out your values, even though your mind may be kicking and screaming and wanting to act and then do something else. So you say no. But that fake it till you make it is just kind of a little, like a sing-song thing.
It's a reconditioning in a certain way, right?
It's a reconditioning, yeah. But it's a discipline. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a value and you're not able to live up to the value. Mm-hmm. But that is your value, and you're doing mm-hmm. the best. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes you're practicing dhamma. Dhamma means you're holding your reaction or the way you want to act inside, and acting in the way that you want to act. Mm-hmm. You're making a choice. You know, shama means shama. These in the sadhana chatushtiya, these fourfold group of values, there's one of them is called the shamadhi shatka. It's a group of six. But the first one is shama, which means that all the thoughts and emotions that arise in your mind, you have a choice to let them go or to act on them. But there are some thoughts and emotions that arise in the mind that grab you. You can't act. They want to express, you know. And so dhamma comes in then where you're able to control those feelings and emotions without acting out. And if you're not acting out, then you're choosing a way to act, that you have a value for. So that's the ability to do that is dhamma. And then the third one is, these are different ones. Now, upadati means the ability to stick with something for a good length of time. Otherwise, whatever you're studying, you become a charlatan. You dabble here and dabble there. You don't have the ability to stick with something that you're interested in to the point of mastery, which can take 12 years. In India, they think to master anything, the beginning of being a master is after 12 years of being engaged in something. So upadati is that ability to actually stick with something. And then titiksha is the ability. The fourth one is the ability to weather the opposites. Like life is sometimes comfortable and sometimes it's not. You know, to be able to accommodate the opposites as they come. And then samadhanam is the ability to keep the mind focused, not as upadati is long term. Samadhanam means like, can I focus? Can I contemplate? Can I listen to a class? Or is my mind all over the place? Can I pay attention at a given point? Am I capable of doing that? Samadhanam. And Shraddha is the sixth one, and that's the, in terms of this knowledge, there's something inside that says that this is true and worth my studying, even though I don't really know if it is. I just feel that it is true and worth my time, and that this teacher knows it. That's Shraddha. Because otherwise, how can you study studying something? I don't think this is true. If that's how you feel, you know, then you wouldn't be studying it. There's something that allows you to give the benefit of doubt to the teacher and to the subject matter that allows you to pursue any given subject, really.
But for all of you, to be a very high-functioning person?
You have to be high-functioning enough. There's going to be a level where the ability for you're not high-functioning enough to even for this to be an option. You probably wouldn't even seek it out, or if you do, you're seeking out really something else, which is a strong, supportive person to help you. Mm-hmm. But it may not, which is true in spiritual groups and in religious groups. There'll be a whole element. There'll be an element of people who are coming into that group for psychological support, not for mumukshutvam, not for a desire for liberation, but a very much a need for for some help.
It's also interesting. What was it called, the six?
The Shamadhi Shatka. It means that Shatka means a group of six. Adi means beginning with Shama.
Shama.
So a group of six mental qualities beginning with Shama. Shamadhi Shatka. So there's Viveka, discrimination. Vairagya, dispassion. The Shamadhi Shatka, that group of six. And then Mumukshutvam. These are the four qualifications for what we call an adhikari, or a qualified student. The Shamadhi Shatka. Sadhana Chatushti, the group of four sadhanas.
Where is it written about?
Everywhere. But say in Vedanta Sara, it's in detail there. Quite a bit of detail, but it's common. So, yeah. Are we done?